This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Right now, get up to 20% off select online storage solutions. Put heavy-duty HDX totes to good use, protecting what's important to you. The solid, impact-resistant design prevents cracking, and the clear base and sides make items easy to find, even when the totes are stacked. Find select online shelving and tote storage up to 20% off at the Home Depot to organize every room in your home, from your garage to your attic. Visit homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully everybody's doing well. I have been on the road for a week or so. I came back, had another client. I'm on the road. I've got two clients this week, so it's a busy week for me coming up. Hopefully get a chance to do a little cutting, and I'll share a couple stories today for me on the road. It's always fun to learn, go new places, you know, explore new areas, and focus on new ecoregion enhancements and thinking through some of the problems the clients have. I enjoy that. The other thing is, this is planting season for a lot of folks. When you're building your cover crop mixes, I really want people to be more conscious, and this deserves a podcast specifically of choice selection, seed volume. But I'll start with one very important point. Please get a chemical analysis of your soil. I think that's very critical. I've been doing reviews of reports from clients from the lab that I asked them to send, you know, their soil to, and I give them inputs and recommendations. I built the ideal soil chart for me, and I have a reference point to look at what the available deficiencies are or available nutrients are, and kind of go through that step by step and send them out a recipe. But You need to get your pH correct. That's super critical. I think a lot of people just want to plant and they're not looking at what the deficiencies are. And if you're deficient in micros, at some point or other, you're going to have to remedy those, because those are essentially the lifeblood of some of the macros. And I think we spoke enough about that with John Kemp to have people recognize that we can't just be nitrogen focused, et cetera. So I just want to put that out there. Definitely deserves more of a content discussion and maybe something in the future. I got Thomas Mills in the back. Thomas hasn't been on in a while. I know he's been busy working with clients. So we're going to get into his world, what he's been up to, just anything that you know he wants to focus the conversation on. We're going to freestyle this one. So looking forward to talking to Thomas. Thomas, hey, what's going on, buddy? How are you?
Good, good. Morning, John. How are you?
Good. It's bright and early, and I'm happy to get you on a call today. It's been a while. I know you've been working with clients, doing a lot of planting, and I can relate to that. So I want to just catch up with you. What have you been working on? What's going on? Have you been client to client? Just fill us in.
Yeah, I've been mostly on current clients. No new clients right now. I kind of paused my consulting game this time of year so I can focus on existing client projects. And, you know, the area that I do most of my work in is the Driftless region in the Midwest. So kind of upper Midwest area, hill country, really. So I've got a lot of tree planting in progress, a lot more yet to do, but site preparation has not been going smoothly because it's been really rainy here and there's just a lot of locations that we can't get into when it's wet. Even with tracked equipment, tracked skid steers, it's just not super efficient and, you know, things just get torn up. So my schedule, I've been doing this for 20 years and I still can never really get my timeline to flow the way I want it to in the spring with a handful of projects because of the weather. You know, you're always trying to delay things or push things out to wait for a drier time, but the only projects that go smoothly are the ones that we have site prepped a year in advance. And that's ideal, right? And that's actually what I tell most clients and push on most clients, but most people don't have the patience for that. So as soon as you handle a plan in February or March, then they want to get everything rolling in April and May, and it just doesn't always work out that way. But that's kind of where I've been. We just wrapped up. Well, actually, I shouldn't say we wrapped up. I still have one more client property to finish the installs on some conifer plantings, combination of like 1 or 2 year old seedlings, you know, the 12 to 24 inch tall seedlings. And then we're also doing some 5 to 7 foot tall transfers on some larger conifers for, you know, faster screening projects. Mm. And then from there, we're going to transition into our orchard plantings.
So let's talk a little bit about conifers species, and you mentioned variation in size. I've got quite a bit of experience planting large and small conifers with different types of equipment. A few years ago, I had a connection and really got some great pricing on, you know, bald and gated conifers, you know, 7, 8 footers, and putting them in the ground, digging the holes, all the preparatory work that goes with that. But I kind of want to go through your process. I think, you know, for some folks are past planting season. Some folks are, it's pretty cold. The place I was just in it, we had snow on the ground and the lakes were still frozen. So, and we're talking May, right? So depending on your location and your green up period, you know, it may be applicable to you, but let's just kind of go through some of your processes, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense. And equipment usually is pretty much key to all this stuff. I don't know how we do as many things we do by hand. So just some of the trials and tribulations.
Yeah. Well, with the larger conifers, this particular situation, I actually scored a pretty good deal with a local guy that had a Christmas tree farm that he decided he didn't want to do Christmas trees anymore. So I bought 300 or so. These are balsam fir and white pine. And I don't necessarily want to say that they're my top choice for screening trees, but they're both natives for this area, which I tend to lean towards. You know, they provide a little bit more ecological benefits. But these particular trees are, like I said, 5 to 7 foot tall. they cut them out with some machine. I have not actually seen the machine firsthand, but based on the uniformity of the root balls, you know, they're probably 5 to 8 gallon root balls if you had to put a volume measurement on them. So they transfer relatively easy. You can move them by hand. I mean, they're not super light, 80 to 100, 120 pounds, depending on how wet they are when you move them. But we're digging them all in by hand. We're hauling them around in the bucket of a tractor, but we're digging them all in by hand. And it's not too bad. You know, you're talking a 12, 18 inch diameter hole, about 10 to 12 inches deep. Again, it really varies from tree to tree, depending on how the root structure of that tree was. Sometimes some of those trees will have, you know, just one big tap root, and sometimes they'll have a really good root structure in general. You know, you just kind of see when you dig them out of the ground or you pop them out of the ground, if they're growing next to a rock and all the roots kind of go on one side, or, you know, if they had good even dispersion of those roots. But ultimately, yeah, we're just transferring them. I can fit, 78 of them in my dump trailer, my 14 foot dump trailer. So I bring about 78 of them home at a time and then disperse them to client properties or try to get them in the ground as soon as possible, obviously. Pretty straightforward. And I'm just kind of following the cue from this guy in this particular planting, because he does a lot of these transplants and just kind of took his advice on how to do all of it.
Now, are they balled and basketed? Meaning, do they have like a canvas over the, you said 5 to 8 gallon, basically that size, the root ball plus like they usually use a basket, like a woven basket or kind of like a fencing basket. Are they set up that way?
These are not.
Okay.
That is what I have dealt with in the past, and it's actually what I anticipated, but I got a really good deal on them. And he said that he doesn't usually do that with them. So as long as you transplant them within a couple of weeks, they usually hold up, and he's been accurate. There's a few of them, you know, I got to think it comes back to the root structure, where if they only have like one big tap root and not a lot of ancillary roots that spurt off of that, you know, they're not holding on to the dirt real well. So I have had a few of them where all the dirt falls off of them in transport, but I would say probably 90%+ of them, you have a nice uniform root ball still intact when you go to plant it. So it's nice, you know, it saves a little bit of time, saves money, obviously, with the time and the cost of the supplies and everything. But yeah, they're pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I've done a few different things and pulled off the basket. I've left the basket on. You know, you have to pull away some of the material. You have to get, you know, allow root for the root exposure, but that's contingent on, you know, the type of soil you're dealing with, you know, based on the location where they're coming from. You know, I'll tell you, my most favorite methodology, and, you know, again, the legalities behind this, but driving down the side of the road, you know, find plants that are growing in harder to develop areas, and you transplant those to better soils. If you have soil prep, and maybe talk a little bit about that, you know, they have a tendency to take off. I've got trees that I planted at the exact same time that have completely taken off, that are not nearly the size of the 7 or 8 footers that I originally planted, but they're a little fuller, they're a little more adapted to the soil. You know, there's that shock period that those larger trees sometimes go through that I always am concerned about. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't happen, but of course, you know, they have to adapt to soil environment. So taking a tree from very bad soil or very different soil than you currently are, you know, utilizing it in may be a factor in its, you know, eventual development. Eventually they adapt, but, you know, they have to have the environment cloned well enough where the tree in and of itself works. One other thing I was going to mention, I use this tool, Titan Attachments makes this tool. It's called the Extreme HD Stump, and I was just using it recently to rip out buckthorn. And I bought it, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, something like that. And basically, it's got teeth on the front of it, so it's great for like hooking into, you know, a tree or a tree ball or a root system and flipping, depending on the size of your tractor, you know, flipping up that root ball or knocking over that tree. But it's also good for digging. You know, it's like a reverse excavator. You know, you're digging out a hole. And that's been pretty well, you know, it works well. It depends on the ground that you're working, how stable and flat it is. But that's a tool that I've been using for quite a few years. And I think I've let some of my clients use it as well, but just because it's almost indestructible.
Yeah, actually, I was eyeballing one of those not that long ago. We got a big project that keeps on getting pushed to the back burner because it's my own project. You know how that goes.
Oh yeah.
And part of that process is moving some dirt around. I'm trying to make more space in my driveway shed area so I can stage more supplies and turn my trailer around. You've been to my house. I live up in the woods and there's not a lot of functional space as far as equipment and stuff like that goes. So try and do that. But I have a couple fruit trees that are planted. You know, when I planted them 4 years ago, it seemed like a good spot for them. And now I'm like, well, I kind of want that moved, but I don't want to disturb it, but I need it moved. And it's small enough that I can still move it. But long story short, that's what I was eyeballing, was something like that. Versus I do have access to a tree planter, but I have to go get it and haul it all around. And to, you know, a big spade that goes on a skid steer. And then, you know, it's just logistically, if you're only moving one or two trees, I was like, maybe I can just use one of those bucket tools and bust it up. And I'm only moving it, you know, probably 40 feet.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of restructuring that area in general. So
are you doing any
soil? It's definitely on my list.
Are you doing any soil prep?
For the tree plantings themselves?
Yeah.
For these conifers, I'm not. Most of them are going from lower quality soil to much higher quality soil. And then we're just kind of looking at the site, you know, the site conditions themselves, trying to make sure that they're going in well-drained soils. But the farm, the Christmas tree farm that they're coming off of, is very, very sandy soil. And they're all going into more of a silty loam. So not heavy soils. You know, we're trying to avoid those heavy soils that don't drain well, but right. Definitely going into soils with a lot more nutrient content.
One thing I would recommend for folks, just an idea, is, and either side, depending if you have any slope, and slope is probably more pertinent to this example, is subsoiling 3 to 4 feet from that root ball location, just for water infiltration purposes this time of year. It's all contingent on what the texture of the soil is. If you're going to make more of a mess, you know, you got to pick those dry periods when you're subsoiling. Just for water catchment, and instead of doing the, you know, the swell system where you're slowing down water in the landscape, you know, catching and distributing and, you know, allowing the plant, there's a few other techniques that I've used, is particularly in areas that have drought conditions, you know, kind of like that half moon shape system where, you know, you're capturing water off the hillside and using mulch in front of the tree to slow it down, and then using this, you know, basically donut-y looking, you know, mound capturing water in and around the root ball. But subsoiling works really good, and it's a pretty quick way to do it on either side of the tree. It's not bad to do it on the down the downward side of that tree as well. So just a small little simple recommendation you can do, and that's just, you know, soil disturbance minimally. So I like those cheap little subsoilers. I think they're $300 from Tractor Supply. They work pretty well.
Yeah, actually, you know, now that you mentioned that, so you said soil prep, I was thinking more of like amending the soil, but most of these trees are going, you know, they're screening trees, right? So we're doing double rows to screen off roadways. One client property had an old tobacco shed on it towards the front end of the property, and he tore that shed down this year, salvaged the lumber for a cabin that he's going to build down the road. But it was at the point where the roof was starting to fall in and stuff, so we had to make decisions. But we replaced that with some of these taller conifers to help screen off the neighboring lot, so on and so forth. But a bunch of them now we're putting in close to box blinds and access routes and just, you know, areas where we want more structure and not sunny enough to get the standard switchgrass or, you know, grass type screening there. So we're kind of tucking them off to the side. And the reason I say that is because I can't really get my tractor back in there real well to subsoil with that ripper on the back. You know, I could kind of back in and pull up, but it's not always as straightforward on those hillsides. And what I did, I actually had a track skid steer with a root grapple on it, a real beast of a root grapple.
Cool.
And what I did was I went out in all those areas where we got plant trees. I just stuck that in the ground, you know, basically giant forks, and just stuck it in the ground and kind of, you know, shook it back and forth and essentially subsoiled it in a, you know, 5 foot wide swath, busting that up and letting it settle back in. I did that about probably 3 weeks before we planted those trees. So it had time for everything to kind of settle back in. Because that's always my main concern with these conifers, especially. I mean, really all trees, older trees, when you plant them, is, you know, making sure they're at the right depth and they don't settle over time. And then, you know, part of that trunk gets buried. But these conifers, especially at that size, you know, if they get too deep, or you dig out a nice round hole and then they settle down into it, and when you have heavier soils relative to the sandier soil in that root ball, then you kind of create this potted effect and it holds a lot of water, and that's not good for those conifers. They'll just get root rot and die within the first couple of years. So
yeah,
you're spot on though. The subsoiling, I've seen major improvements if you can subsoil.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
And I'm doing subsoiling in a bunch of different applications now, just because I see the value of it and the expediency of you know, applying it on the landscape, even breaking up a hard pan. You know, one thing I'm going to mention, and this is going to go totally left on the conversation, is there's been so much, I'll say, advertisement around certain techniques and not using this plant versus that plant. Like ryegrass is a good example, you know, and I've used that multiple times in areas that have a hard pan. A hard pan could be really high or low in the soil profile. You've really got to take your time and dig a hole and look at where that hard pan explicitly is. Again, a plant that people, you know, poo-poo, but these fibrous root systems that are, you know, easy to terminate, plants easy to terminate, that create, you know, some biomass, but can navigate those harder soils is really critical. And, you know, subsoiler is another technique to that. And adding amendments, you know, in and around that kind of cut out area, you know, via subsoiler would be a good concept for people to start looking at. Now, I want to talk a little bit about tree plantings in regards to spacing. I think spacing is an important topic. I've seen folks do this all different ways. You and I have talked about this recently with willows, and I probably want to get to that in a little bit. But, you know, staggered, if you have the spacing, staggered for road screening tends to be, in my opinion, the best option. I've found that to look appealing. It's generally easier to manage. There's usually better spacing between trees. But spacing is always that critical, like, hey, am I thinking 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, or 50 years? And am I doing it layering, where I'm replacing one layer in the front or one layer in the back over time? Because if you have this like row of staggered trees, and let's say, for example, you know, you're thinking 20 years ahead and you're thinking about the umbrella or columnar effect or whatever, however that tree is going to look, whatever tree choice that you have, what does that look in X amount of time? And I've seen examples where guys are like, I want to screen in 6 or 8 years. Well, that changes the game. And a non-native Norway spruce, you know, has a tendency to not lose its lower branches and related needles. And that, you know, that integration of trees, that the gap's going to be closer. So I think thinking through this maybe a little bit on your end, I think would be important for folks to think through.
Yeah, 100%. So one of the things on that topic this year, you know, I'm installing these conifer screens based on plans for clients I have. And then, you know, on top of that, guys see me doing that and I'll buy excess trees. So I sell trees to local people and kind of help them put together a tentative plan and whatnot too. So I'm always kind of explaining that at a high level and then detail level, just like you're saying. But that those are things that we have to think about. You know, trees, I like to refer to conifers as kind of the OGs of screening, right? Like there's not much better of a screen than a conifer, but it takes time, right? It takes time for those to fill in. And then some types of conifers do kind of have that peak in their efficacy. White pines are a good example of that. They grow a lot faster than a lot of the spruce and stuff, but they lose their needles in the bottom over time. So you know, you tend to get a really nice tall tree that starts to thin out a little bit. And that's fine. You can adapt to that or accommodate that, I should say. So like this year, what we did with this combination of balsam fir and white pine is most of the like the roadway screening projects that we did a row of balsam fir closer to the road. And then we did a row of white pine behind that. So and they're staggered and we varied it a little bit from property to property. But generally, we were doing about 8 foot spacing or up to 12 foot spacing in those staggered rows. And just to add to that, something I always consider with that spacing is, yes, you know, what is it going to look like now? What is it going to look like down the road? But also the maintenance factor there. You know, if you're trying to get in between those rows to mow, You know, if there's grass competition, weeds that you're trying to manage, it's hard to avoid those areas with, you know, as far as absence of management, because there's so many invasives popping up all the time. You almost have to get in and mow at least once in a while. So thinking about what equipment you have, being able to maneuver around those trees to mow and maintain them, even if they're just in a nice straight row where you can go, you know, as close as possible to mow it and keep that maintained. The other factor there with layers of screening and accommodating, you know, that lower zone as those trees grow and maybe do cast some lower needles, I like to add a strip of grass, switchgrass or, you know, other tall grasses in front of that if possible. That adds challenges in and of itself, because typically if we're going to plant a warm season grass like that, it's nice to have it set up where you can burn it off every so often, but you can't burn right up against those trees, obviously. So, you know, leaving enough space between those trees, if you're going to add grass where you can mow a small burn break in there, that's also advantageous. So, you know, all those things come into play. All those things should go into consideration when planting those trees. And then the last thing I wanted to mention on that is, you know, the variance in the tree size and the age that you plant it. So the same client property that we planted a road screen with 5 to 7 foot tall conifers at, I think that property we did 8 foot spacing, 10 foot spacing, 2 staggered rows. On the other side of the property where we weren't looking for immediate screening, but we were trying to, you know, develop screening over time, we planted a bunch of seedlings. And in that situation, we used 3-point tree planter, and we planted 75. It was a combination of, and I didn't pick these, the client ordered these, but they were balsam fir, Fraser fir, white spruce, I believe. And they're about 12 to 24 inch tall seedlings. There's quite a variety or discrepancy between the smallest and the largest, but we planted 75 of them in like 15 minutes with a tree planter. I went down, made a pass with my flail mower tight to the ground, unhooked it, hooked onto the tree planter. I should say it took a little longer than that because I prepped everything. You know, I went through, I used a big meat cleaver and a cutting board, and essentially I trimmed the roots down so that they fit better in that trench and we're not getting balled up roots or J-hooked roots sticking out of the ground, stuff like that. Had them all prepped, had them all laid out. And then, you know, basically two guys on the planter, one guy is putting trees in the trench as it opens and closes, and the other guy is pulling trees out of the bag and handing them to the guy that's actually planting them. But yeah, we planted all that in really short order. And those we planted at roughly a 5 foot spacing. We were kind of looking at this adjacent fence, barbed wire fence that I just said, you know, basically plant one every fence post and one in between, you know, so the fence posts are roughly 10 feet apart, 10, 12 feet apart. So they're kind of gauging it that way. Now the mindset there is a little bit different than planting the more expensive, more labor intensive, time consuming 5 to 7 foot tall conifers. We're anticipating a very high survival rate on those taller trees, right? They're not going to handle, or they're not going to have as much issues with deer nipping the terminal buds. They're already fairly well established. You know, we're going to know pretty quickly if they're going to survive or not. On the other side of that, those smaller plantings, they're going to take some deer browse pressure. There's going to be some trees that just don't handle the transplant. Some aren't going to survive. So that's why I planted them that much, or at that higher density, that closer spacing.
Yep.
But the goal with that, and, you know, what I would suggest to people, and this is kind of what I do, is, you know, if five, six years down the road, you're looking at that row of conifers and your survival rate was good, then you just dig some of them up and move them, you know, and they're not too big to handle. You can then, you know, you basically create your own source of the 5 to 7 foot tall conifers on your own property. And a lot of times similar soil types, and sometimes you're just moving them, you know, 100 yards, but we have that option at this point, right? Or, you know, if we want to, we can go through and cut every other one out of that row to thin them out a little bit, or else they're going to start to overcrowd at some point. But, you know, again, we're anticipating some loss there. My experience with those, specifically balsam fir and Fraser fir, is the deer, they will eat those. they don't tend to eat the balsam as much. And those older balsams, they don't seem to bother as much either. You know, they're a really sharp needle, but they do like to nibble on the terminal buds of both those plants and the Fraser firs especially. So that's what we're just kind of anticipating or planning for, some loss in that area. Now, I would say with both balsam fir and Fraser fir, if the deer are really hammering those on your property, it's probably because there's a lack of better browse out there. So you can kind of use that as a gauge as far as what the browse availability is on the rest of the property. But essentially we are anticipating some loss in a planting like that. But again, when you kind of relate that to the time it takes to plant and the cost of the plant themselves, you know, I think he got those 75 seedlings for a couple $100, you know, and then like I said, just a short amount of time to plant them and you're good to go. So it's a lot cheaper, but yeah. You know, again, your success rate's not going to be as high for a situation like that.
Everything you said in there, I think, is really pertinent, is your sizing and your kind of planning ahead for loss or gains, and the whole transplanting idea of planting, you know, trees in 5 or 4 or 6 foot spacing and then either cutting them out or replanting them using kind of as nursery stock, I think is pretty good. One example, just on my own property, I got some white pine in and I went out and planted those. I think I have like, oh my gosh, I told you I was done planting, but I have another 50 or 60 trees to go. And I just, you know, nights and weekends, right, when you're home. But I the white pine I planted now, I did not protect those. I put them in corridors, which is the wrong place to put them, without any protection. I'm just going to bud cap them here this summer, you know, towards the end of summer. And I've got some plastic material that I found. Again, it's, you know, I just staple it on top of the book, you know, the top, the terminal bud, and I don't have any issues with those. And I usually keep that on for 3-4 years. Once they get above browse height, then usually I'm okay. You know, they will eat the needles, but again, hopefully I have, you know, food sources available in there to distract them, so they're not concentrating, you know, themselves, the deer on those specific plants. Let's bump over. I think those are some good examples. And I do agree with preferences and paying attention to the preferences of, you know, deer to, you know, the conifer that you're selecting. And I agree with, you know, exactly what you said. Let's get over to some other planting. You said orchard planting's coming up. We've talked about this before in the podcast, Orchard Edge, or whatever, you know, focus point that you have. I've got a lot of my crabapple trees or apple trees in the ground. I have a whole system where I go from tubing to caging, and everyone does this differently because I want to reuse those tubes, put them on another tree, and increase the cycle of protection, you know, as a eventual tree evolves. I really like crabapple trees that have low branching. I know that's contrary to what a lot of folks have, but I like that protection that they provide. So caging's a lot nicer of an option, but in this exact example, you know, I don't have, you know, $1 million to spend on cages, but you've been buying fence left and right. So, you know, maybe talk about, you know, some of the plantings, things that you're doing, adding mulch, amendments, what have you.
Yeah. So this year I'm changing up my bigger scale planting. So, you know, we're always, I know you're in the same boat. We're always trying new things. And then when you see the efficacy or the promise behind a new technique, then I extend that onto the client properties. But I try not to push anything on the bigger scale until I know that's going to be effective, because a lot more time and money lost there. And I warranty all my planting, you know, no matter where the tree comes from, what the situation is, I warranty every tree that goes in the ground if I plant it. If I'm just handing it over to a client, that's a little bit different story. But if I'm there, you know, focused on the site prep, all the things that go with it, then I warranty that. So it costs me a lot of time and money if I screw things up. But this year, I've changed things up a little bit. Actually, I think I just posted a story yesterday on Instagram because I was out checking a client property that a different tree company had planted a handful of trees on. And then the next year I planted a handful of trees and I was just kind of looking at them and kind of gauging the success rate of those trees based on the plantings and the stock of the actual plants themselves. But I really do like wood mulch. You know, we've used plastic mulch. We use a tree survival kit that we have a pretty high success rate with, where we put down basically a 3 foot square of plastic with a little fertilizer pack and a tree tube. And those work fairly well in some situations. but in some situations they don't work at all. And my experience the last few years doing more and more of these types of plantings is you'll have some properties where I think it's probably skunks, maybe raccoons, but I'm assuming skunks come and they can smell grubs or insects or something underneath there. I don't know. Maybe there's coyotes, foxes going after mice or voles that hang out underneath that plastic. But essentially that plastic gets ripped up. Half of it will get ripped up or ripped off. Then there's problems there. But the idea behind that system is you're creating a weed barrier first and foremost, right? So that's one of the biggest things that you should never overlook with fruit tree plantings or pretty much any tree plantings is the competition specifically with those grasses, right? You and I were talking about this not that long ago about how much moisture the grasses rob and obviously the resources with that.
Right.
But that weed mat really helps suppress the grasses. And then the concept there is it doesn't hold the water it holds water, but it's impermeable. So there's not as much moisture underneath that weed mat as there is outside of it. So it kind of forces those trees to grow the root system out a little faster to seek the added moisture relative to what's underneath that weed mat. And it seems to work fairly well. I very, very rarely go back and water trees. We had a really bad dry summer 2 years ago, and I think my success rate on those fruit tree and shrub plantings was still in the upper 80s to low 90th percentile. So I was pretty happy with that across the board. You know, if it's a property where landowner lives there, there's easy access to water, they have equipment where they can take a IBC tote, 300 gallons at a time out and water trees, I absolutely suggest it. But some of these properties, by the time I haul my equipment and, an IBC tote full of water weighs a lot. So if I'm hauling that 40 miles, like that really starts to add up on the cost time and time thing. But I don't water a whole lot. I don't like to water if I don't have to. So we've had pretty good success there. But again, in a lot of situations, that stuff gets ripped up. And I'm just trying to figure out more and more ways to get away from plastic on the landscape.
Yeah.
Short term, it's not the end of the world. But I hate walking properties and finding garbage all over the place. And if I'm the one that left that garbage there, it makes me feel like I'm kind of going against my own morals with how I set things up. So we're trying to get away from that. But with that, the added benefit of wood mulch and how it improves the soil and increasing the, the biological activity specifically in that soil, I think it's hard to overlook that. And if I can, where I can, I go for wood mulch. And this year we kind of shifted our system over to where we're going to be doing as much wood mulch as absolutely possible. Again, there's all sorts of logistical challenges that come with wood mulch, which is why this other system with the plastic mulch was developed. But that's part of it, right? The mulching is part of it. And one particular property that I have in mind, I'm kind of thinking about as I explain this, has really poor soil, really, almost beach sand-like soil. So there's no benefit to your soil by using plastic. It does nothing to improve the soil, right? But if we put down wood mulch, then we're slowly improving that soil. We're doing all the same things as the plastic mulch, retaining the moisture, suppressing the weed growth. But at the same time, as that wood mulch breaks down, then, the insects and the earthworms and all that stuff, they're pulling that added nutrients that, basically composted cellulose down into the soil and increasing the biodiversity and the biological activity there. So really trying to focus on that. I've got a handful of things, trying to mix in some compost with the bottom layer or, added fertility. Some of the top layers, we're going to be mixing in some mushroom spores from our mutual friend Mushroom Matt up there in Michigan. So I'm trying to just maximize the abundance in these food systems. But I really, really like the idea of wood mulch. And, again, with that is really the maintenance side of things. So you've got mulching and then you've got the protection side and then the ongoing maintenance. So trying to marry all of those thoughts or concepts together in a way that's efficient is, it's always the challenge and we're always trying to improve it.
Yeah.
But this year, what I'm doing, instead of caging each individual tree, we're trying to maximize that space anyways. So with these orchard edges, typically we do a tree and a couple shrubs and a tree and a couple shrubs, you know, just at a high level. It's a little more detailed than that. Sometimes we're doing, you know, a couple overstory trees and an understory tree and then a couple shrubs and yada, yada, yada. But we're trying to get as much going in that row as possible to fill in every niche in that ecosystem that we're building. You know, so again, orchard edge concept there is mimicking that natural forest ecosystem with taller, longer living trees, mostly nut producing trees, and then filling in the understory trees with more soft mass type trees. And then underneath that, we're plugging in shrubs. And I don't generally go out and plant the brambles. Usually after a few years, they start to show up from the birds and the native seed bank and whatnot. So we fill in all those layers in there. But instead of rolling out miles of welded wire, you know, the 2x4 inch square welded wire, and then cutting it in 10 foot sections like I've done so many times, which, you know, is effective. And I've figured out ways to be efficient using the 2x4 and then cordless angle grinder. You can cut a lot of wire in a short amount of time, but it's still a lot of work. And then every one of those trees needs, you know, 2 to 3 T posts in the ground and wire, and you know, you're making an individual cage out of every single one of those situations. It's not the end all be all. You know, you still have to tube the trees at some level, whether it's protective rodent gear at the bottom, or, you know, if it's a younger tree and you're doing the full tube and whatnot. Because if you just tube the trees, it's a 50-50 shot if the deer are going to mess with the tube, if the deer are going to reach up and nip on that terminal bud, or what they're going to do. So typically we tube the tree and we cage the tree. And then in time, actually, I leave the tubes on the trees as long as I possibly can. And then I'll take the cage down a little bit sooner once I know that tree is tall enough that the deer aren't going to nip that terminal bud. Now, what you were saying about having a shorter, bushier tree, I 100% agree with, or some of those understory trees or like the apple, crab apple, stuff like that. But with those overstory trees, I want those trees to grow tall. I don't want as many low branches because I want a tree that is going to produce abundance and mass for the wildlife, but yeah, potentially have timber value down the road at the same time. So with all that, it's kind of my long way of going back around to say my change in planting this year. I'm planting everything in blocks. So I'm planting everything in blocks that are either 45 or 95 foot increments. So, you know, maybe 95 feet, it might be 195 feet, might be 495 feet. And basically the reason for that is if we do it in those 45 or 95 foot increments, then I can put a T post in on the corner, on each corner. And basically with a 100-foot roll or a 50-foot roll of wire, I can go 5 feet across and 45 foot down or 95 feet down. And then another roll of wire, go 5 feet across and 95 feet back. And I've got block that I fenced off in 20 minutes with a quarter of the number of T-posts required. And it's just really fast to set up. And then when I need to get to doing my maintenance, I can just kind of open up one end and I can walk right down that block. Now the goal there is to, again, tube all the trees, tube all the shrubs within there for rodent protection. And after a few years, we're going to pull off the tubes from the shrubs, let them get bushier, and then, you know, probably another year we'll give those shrubs to adapt or really get established, and then we'll take the whole fence down once we know that those trees are tall enough. But my issue with the tree tubes, kind of that double-edged sword of tree tubes, is if the tree isn't in there long enough and you take that tube off, you have a very limp, weak stem that's developed in that tube, right? The combination of growing faster in the tube and then not having to fight the elements, you know, taking the wind because it's getting the support from that tube and the tree stake that's, or the stake that's holding the tube itself. So we got to get that tree up out of the tube far enough where it starts to take the wind pretty well and it's wobbling around, and then that's going to strengthen the trunk of that tree. And until it's at that point, don't really want to take it out of the tube. Now, there's two ways to look at that, right? If we take it out of the tube and it's not in a cage, there's always the potential and high likelihood that a buck is going to come down that row at some point and rub on that tree and potentially girdle it and kill it, right? So again, the tubes, try and keep them out as long as possible, or, you know, the other option is to leave them caged longer and take the tubes off sooner. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do it. I'm curious what your take is on that.
I like having these corridors where you have sectioned off tree plantings that are in a regular shape, not necessarily square. So I like a circular format in form for fencing exterior to that. Interior, I'm going to have a combination thereof. So I'm going to mostly focus on, depending what I'm doing, is non-edibles around that fencing to protect, you know, you're building these gills of plants. And then interior, my focus is probably, I try to have leftover stuff, right? I try to have leftover fencing that I can reuse all the time. So, you know, some of these shrubs, depending on their form, like Redders or Dogwood is a good example. I'll overplant like 200 or 300% with some fencing, with some open, with some, you know, within the fencing that I'm talking about. And so you're basically having fencing within fencing. I have a hard time getting grip of that because it's just so much work, right? But, you know, the end result is, you know, enough, I'll say, containment where you're protecting from deer, you know, rodents mostly, because usually that's, you know, rabbits are predominantly the species that I'm most concerned with, at least in our areas, with hunting as well, right? That's the whole reason we hunt, you know, small game. I don't have an issue putting tubes on shrubs. I don't like the whole concept around, you know, leaving them on forever. So taking them off, letting them eventually branch out once the terminal bud's above browsable height. But again, it depends on the plant. Like, you know, I'm leaving tubes on certain deciduous trees until I feel like, you know, they're not going to get rubbed on. And that could be 15 years. And so, you know, this whole, and then you've got ground maintenance, right? You got to get in there and maintain, you know, the ground vegetation. And so you're trying to fill in all these gaps. And that's another piece of it that's a little bit trickier. On my particular personal property, you know, I'm very individualistic. You know, trees are not, you know, they're planted individually. There's a spacing requirement. You know, there's ability to work on them and maintain them. I try to stay away from these. If I had a field setting, completely different scenario, but I predominantly my own personal property is, you know, 95% wooded. So when I'm opening up an area, I'm dealing with vegetation competition anyhow. And we've talked about building, you know, wattles on this podcast, dead hedging, you know, some other options that are naturalized to keep deer out of certain areas. And then, you know, slash piles, retention slash, all the stuff, any residual material, you know, debris piles. And those create a whole another host of animal interest in those particular areas. But the one thing I'm starting to play with now is these Courier coconut mats. I think I mentioned it to you before, and using them kind of as a means, you know, laying them out in a roll. I think I'm going to do that next with the willows. And, you know, some varieties of trees are going to get browsed on or rubbed on. But the reality of it is if you apply more trees or you have more trees in the landscape, your lost percentages are going to be in some reasonable form that you're generally okay with. But that means you got to go continue to work on the interior of the property to create that food offset, so they're not, you know, point focused on everything that you're planting. But, you know, your system of blocking and managing internally is like functional. It makes a lot of sense to me. It's extremely reasonable. The client will absolutely benefit from it. And the layering system that you're talking about, I guess I have one question for you. That was a roundabout way of saying, I agree with everything you're doing. It's just, you can do it in different forms and fashion. And, you know, I think having these stronger, more vigorous tree species, a lot of it's the seed stock. Are you buying good quality seed stock? No different from buying good quality food plot seed and putting in a good environment. I mean, the goal is if you have both, you get better, an outcome. And so, you know, trying to find good seed sources, you know, I think I told you before, like, I'm extremely impressed with Forest Ag's chestnuts. I think they have grown tremendously compared to any other chestnut that I've seen. Now, who knows what the production quality is going to be? And you don't know that until the tree's in that, you know, 10 to 15 year age range. So some of these trees, you don't necessarily appreciate how well they do. They may grow really quick, but do they actually produce a nut or any mass that you absolutely want on the landscape? So, you know, again, you're projecting hopefulness, and I don't like that, but sometimes you do that with mass plantings and then you individually select for trees that are producers. So my recommendation is plant more, protect more, get good seed stock and, you know, be more conscious of what the outcome could be with that. Some people really want to be razor focused on this particular individual planting. Well, if I know there's a good, you know, seed source and I'm using a good, relatively good seed source, and we know that there's a good outcome. I think the Blue Hill Nursery is a good example out here in Pennsylvania. They really have a good resource for folks. So, but again, I mean, it's all different. The other thing I was just going to mention was, I want to get to willows here in a second, if you don't mind, because that's something you and I are kind of focusing in on. And I want the audience to pay attention because I will have willow varieties for folks next year. It's just in a fencing form, and that's a variety. I don't think you have any of those, but you'll get some probably next year. It's a slightly different variety that I've worked on here. You and I are playing with a couple different varieties right now. But, you know, just trying to think through, how do we not have this plastic all over the landscape? And having that as a resource that we can either reuse, but isn't degrading or ripping up or just polluting kind of the environments that they're working in. The wood mulch concept that you're using works really well. Oh, I've got a question in all this. You were talking about understory plants within your fruit trees. You mentioned any type of briar. What are the other plants that you're using? I'm thinking mulberry might be one of the options if you can keep it in shrub form. Are there any other plants that you're using in and around those fruit trees that maybe the audience would be concerned with or would think is helpful?
Hey everyone, I'd like to thank you for listening to part one of the podcast. In part two, Tom Mills and I get into a bunch of different topics surrounding hedgerows, client issues, solutions, focusing on orchard edges, as well as willows and construction of willows on the landscape. Thanks for listening.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.